Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
You know how I feel about the sport of tennis. It's a sport that I go way back with. I go back a long way. I love that sport. It's a sport that I used to talk about quite a bit on the program back in the day. Brad Gilbert, who if memory serves was ranked as high as number four in the world, used to come on this show quite a bit. We talk tennis and we talk about the Raiders. Some of my favorite conversations ever in this business, on this show, on any of my TV shows, have been with Andre Agassi and Jimmy Connors. In fact, let me sidebar with you right now. Story time, right off the top of the program. I'm not sure I've ever done this, but I will. And not to name drop and not to make it about me, but to illustrate how much I love this sport. So back in the day, I had a pretty close relationship, you know, professionally, with Team Agassi back in the day. Andre Agassi, Brad Gilbert, mental and physical guru, Gil Reyes. Close enough that one year, Andre Agassi, when he was still married to Brooke Shields, he invites Janet and I to their New Year's Eve party at their house. A couple of thoughts here. I've never really been about that life. Never really been about the see and be seen game. Keep that in mind. Number two, Andre Agassi is an extremely private person. As a media member, to even get an invite like that to a party like that is pretty amazing. So I gotta admit, I was all about that. I was really into that. And Janet is into doing different things, so I knew she'd be all in. I knew that she would think that was different and cool and fun. So I'm going to be a legend. Not only am I planning New Year's Eve that year, I've got a great plan. Something totally different and something totally cool. Keep in mind, this is way back in the day. I'm going to say this probably was 1998, 1999, 20 years ago. So I'm all hyped. I can't wait to tell Janet about this great New Year's plan. And she immediately shoots it down, saying, we already have plans. We do? None that I know of, and I guarantee they're not as good as the plan I have. She proceeds to tell me we are going to San Francisco that weekend to do New Year's Eve with a couple of her friends. To which I respond, oh, hell no. We're not going to Frisco. We are going to drive across town to Brentwood and kick it with Andre and Brooke and BG and Gil. Janet proceeds to tell me, look, I think it's amazing and awesome that Andre included us. Really great. However, this is not what we're about. We're not going to go all Hollywood. We are going to be real. We are going to be with our best friends, the people who were with us before anything good happened to us and still will be with us when something bad happens to us. And we're going to spend New Year's Eve with this couple and be among our best friends. Well, they're among your best friends, not mine. But I'm not really sure how to overcome that objection. You know, the objection being that we're not going to sell out. We're not going to go Hollywood. We're going to be real with our real friends. Well, needless to say, that weekend sucked. That couple didn't last much longer than that weekend, and I never got invited to another Andre Agassi event ever again. That said, Andre is one of my favorite athletes ever. He wrote one of the best sports books I've ever read, and I love tennis. Purpose of the story, I love tennis. Always have, always will. Having said that, we don't talk as much tennis as we used to. Not because I don't like it, but because nobody talks as much tennis as they used to. And it's kind of been that way for most of this century. And I'm not going to beat you over the head. I'm not going to lecture you with it. I'm not going to say that you just don't get it. You don't understand. You're missing out. Like, I do understand. It's not for everybody. I'm not going to go all get off my lawn and tell you, you need to study the classics. Or breakfast at Wimbledon used to be a thing. That it's not like it was back in the days with Borg and McEnroe and Connors and Lendl and Courier and Agassi and Sampras. However, if you were near a TV or a laptop yesterday for a brief window, it was like that. Here's your final score. 7-6, 1-6, 7-6, 4-6, 13-12. If you know tennis, you know what those numbers mean. You know what 12 in the fifth means. If you don't, that's all right. Probably sounds like I'm rattling off stock prices. Just know this. For 4 hours and 57 minutes, Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer battled their asses off in one of the greatest matches ever played at Wimbledon or anywhere else. I say one of because nothing's ever going to top Federer and Rafa Nadal back in 08 in the final. But this was close. Really close. And the fact that Federer was involved in another epic final more than a decade later, a few weeks before turning 38. against the world number one and one of the best to ever pick up a racket is pretty unreal. It's pretty unreal. It's unreal, but it's brutal that he lost both of those finals. My man's got 20 grand slams. He is a blade of grass away from at least 22. But his performance yesterday was epic. Now, that's a word that gets thrown around quite a bit. In fact, way too much. But yesterday was an epic day. It was so good that people started throwing out cliches like, somebody had to lose. Tennis was the real winner. But those things are actually true. But I can't come in here and say that Roger Federer really won that match. He didn't. He lost. In fact, not only did he lose, I'd go as far as to say he let it get away. Notice I'm not saying he choked. I'm not going to go all hot take like that. I'm not saying he choked. I'm not saying he went into the tank. I am saying he let it get away. And nobody knows that better than Federer. This guy's up double match point. Serving for the match. Serving to add to his legacy. You have to finish. And he didn't. You've got to finish because it had been 71 years since a male player at Wimbledon had overcome match point to win. Think about that. More than seven decades since somebody overcame match point to win. Djokovic overcame two. This is why you have to choke that guy, especially that guy out, or he's going to come back and kill you, and he did. And as any great athlete will tell you, they remember the worst beats more than they do their best wins. I've never met an athlete who hasn't said that. And as great as Federer was yesterday, and as much as he said that he'll turn the page as quickly as he can on this and move on, he won't. He can't. How could he? He knows. He knows that on the verge of turning 38, he's never going to have a better look at another Wimbledon title or even another slam than he did yesterday. And it got away. So this notion that there were no losers yesterday, only winners, is wrong. Federer definitely lost. The scoreboard says it. He knows it. And the thing that has to be really troubling to Federer, he was the better player for most of the day, except on the bigger points, except in the tiebreakers, when it mattered most. The Joker, he was not at his best. You know, like a pitcher having to find a way to grind out a win when he does not have his best stuff. Joker was mentally tougher, and he did play bigger on the bigger points. That was the difference. Something that Federer knows and something that I'm sure is going to stay with him. But he's got nothing to be ashamed of. Played his guts out, left it all out there. Nothing to be ashamed of, but don't tell me it won't stick to him because it will. In the meantime, let me say, the two of them put on a hell of a show. If I'm talking tennis at all on this show, it's because they put on a hell of a show. If I'm leading this show with tennis, you know something historic happened. So no, I'm not going to crack you over the head with it and say that if you've got a problem with that sport or that match, you've got a problem with yourself. Notice I'm not saying that. I really don't care if you don't care. I'm fine if you don't care. Just know I do. And I thought that was one of the greatest tennis matches I've ever seen. And given that no one is really talking about that sport much these days, it was my job to start the show with the best thing that I saw all weekend. And seeing this guy save two match points at Wimbledon in Federer's house when everybody was going crazy for him was one of the best things I've seen in tennis ever. Because it doesn't happen. You know, like some things are not possible in sports, you think? Sort of like blocking Kareem Skyhook, sort of like walking off on Mariano Rivera. There's certain things you don't see in sports. You don't see that guy saving two match points against that other guy. Not when everybody else in that house is cheering for the alleged GOAT. One more thought that I want to share. For everybody cheering for Federer and nobody wanting Novak to win, he knew that, but he had a technique for dealing with that.
I like to transmute it in a way. So when the crowd is chanting Roger, I hear Novak. So that's. I know it sounds silly, but it is like that. I try to convince myself that it's like that.
It actually sounds awesome to me. I like to transmutate it. Holy crap! He likes to transmutate it. My man, right when you thought it couldn't get any better, Novak goes out there and drops a transmutate on everybody in the room. And then after he transmutated those Roger chants into Novak chants, he went out and he transmutated the rest of the match into a Novak match.
Second serve from Federer to Djokovic to the backhand. Djokovic returns cross court. Federer misses one! Novak Djokovic! is a Wimbledon champion for the fifth time, and he does it by saving two match points against Roger Federer to prevail.
Transmutation complete. Summer's heat can be draining on your vehicle's battery. Rising temperatures can cause battery fluids to evaporate. So stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts right now and have your battery tested free of charge. If your battery does need to be replaced, the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts will help you find the exact superstar battery that fits your car or truck at a guaranteed low price. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Michael Malone is my guest. Michael, so good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jim, and always great to be on with you.
Always good to talk to you, Michael. Thanks so much. I know you took some time off after the season. You got a chance to decompress. Also, as you said, to look within. One of the things I always enjoy about our conversations is the fact that you're always somebody who's looking within, trying to figure out what you can do to be better. What was the process like for you after this season?
Well, thankfully, it was a little different than the last few years where we came up one game short of making the playoffs. 2 years in a row prior to this season. So to finally break through in our fourth year here in Denver and to be not just a playoff team, Jim, but a dangerous playoff team, beating San Antonio in a game seven and then obviously getting to another game seven. So what a great experience for a young team. And that is only going to help us. My biggest concern, to be very honest, Jim, is 2 years in a row of not making it, you've got, you know, that's a motivating factor. Well, now we've made it. We got this second round, and I have to make sure that our players are not complacent. They're not coming up for air. They're not thinking that we've arrived because we haven't done anything yet. Our ultimate goal is still to bring a championship to the city of Denver.
We're talking to Michael Malone. You know, it's a really honest point, a really honest answer. I mean, when you don't have that pain of missing the playoffs to serve as motivation, then you have to do that, right? You've got to fight complacency. You have to make sure guys don't get too comfortable. How do you go about doing that?
Well, constant communication, having conversations with players, sending out random text messages, you know, make sure our guys are working, we're staying hungry. And, you know, being a number two seed this year and winning a division and the things that you mentioned as we came into this conversation, people are getting ready to play for us. You know, the first 3 years, we were a team that nobody really gave much credit to and much credence to. Well, that's changed. We are a team that, you know, we're going to get other teams' best every single night. I think the question was, well, can this team perform at a high level on the big stage in the playoffs? And I think we answered that question at a pretty high level. Nikola Jokic, you know, I don't think anybody was really viewed him as a player that was going to play at the level he played at in the playoffs. He was just remarkable. So we have to make sure that next season, understand, every night we play, we're no longer a team that no one respects. We are on people's radar, and we're going to get their best every single night, and we have to prepare for that, and we have to be ready for that.
Nuggets head coach Michael Malone joining us. Michael, stay on that point of Jokic for a minute. He was a monster in the regular season, but he went to a completely new level in the postseason. Like, specifically, what did he show you from a mental and maturity standpoint with the way he showed up on the big stage?
I don't have enough adjectives to describe Nikola's play, and we all know how talented he is, how skilled he is, how unselfish he is. His IQ is off the charts, Jim. But I think what really stood out to me was he is always being criticized as, well, he's not athletic enough. He's not in good enough shape. And I think he put those things to rest in the playoffs. And the game that jumps out to me is game three against Portland. And we lose a four overtime game, and I played him 65 minutes. And the best part about this story is that Nikola and everybody else on our team, we didn't feel sorry for ourselves. We came back in game four and won a very important game in Portland after that loss. So for a guy to be able to play at that high of a level, the minutes that were placed upon him, the demands that were placed upon him, I think shows that maybe looks are deceiving. This kid is in great shape. He's in great conditioning, and he is a mentally tough kid going through this for the first time. So that's what really impressed me about Nikola was his mental approach, his mental edge, and his mental toughness.
We're talking to Michael Malone. So, Michael, you improved the win total each of your last 4 years. It's a pretty amazing accomplishment in and of itself, especially when you're doing it in the Western Conference. But I know that you're looking to make it five straight, but how do you go about improving upon 54 wins?
Yeah, it's going to be a tremendous challenge. You know, we're the only team, to your point, Jim, that has improved in each of the 4 years, which is a really remarkable accomplishment. And the best part about it is, you know, we haven't had the Wonder Twins team up and come to Denver. Like you see all over the Western Conference, everybody's kind of teaming up and going here in the dynamic duo fashion. We've done it the old-fashioned way. We've earned it, we've worked for it, and we've developed all of our young players. So to do that 4 years in a row with such a young team speaks to the work and the effort that our coaches, that our front office, that our ownership, and our most importantly, our players have put in. But it'll be a challenge. You know, we could really realistically have a better season this year and maybe not win 54 games. You know, the West, the landscape changes so quickly. All I care about is, are our players working right now? Are we getting better? Are we going to address the areas that maybe we didn't do a good enough job in last year? And that's something I take great pride in. We have improved every year because we as an organization spent a lot of time in the summer figuring out what are the biggest concerns, how do we get better, and then teaching our guys and getting them to buy in. And I would say our greatest strength, Jim, has to be our continuity. You have all these other players that are coming together for the first time and joining up, which is great, and that's exciting, and the fans in the NBA should love that. But what we have over a lot of teams is year five for me and year three, four for most of our players. So there's continuity. That allowed us to get off to a great start last season, and we're hoping that's going to allow us to get off to another great start this year.
We're talking to Michael Malone. We'll do so for another couple of minutes. Michael, you mentioned the West. I mean, what a fascinating offseason it's been, and the landscape has changed dramatically. As you look at the conference now heading into the upcoming season, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Well, it's, you know, every time you think nothing crazier can happen, something else happens.
Right.
You know, I thought everything was kind of over with on coming back from Las Vegas for our Jeremy Grant press conference, who I'm so excited to have on our team now to be a part of our family. I think he's a tremendous pickup. But then you see the whole Russell Westbrook and Chris Paul trade. So the West is nuts. You know, you have Kawhi and Paul George. You have LeBron and Anthony Davis. You have Russell Westbrook and James Harden now. Well, you know what? We've got our team. And every year there's been some player or multiple players coming to the Western Conference. We don't concern ourselves about that. We don't waste time worrying about that. As long as we're doing our job, looking within, working hard, and coming back as improved players, improved coaches, and improved team, the rest will take care of itself.
Michael, you mentioned Grant. What do you like about his game, and how do you see him fitting into your team?
Well, I tell you, there's so many things I love about Jeremy Grant. You know, you start off with he's a young 25-year-old player coming off of a career year, career high in points, career high in rebounds, and a career high 39% from the three-point line. So I think he's just kind of breaking into who he can be as a player. And what I also love is that, and our analytics guys kind of talked about this when we were discussing this trade, we are a ball movement team. We play through Nikola Jokic a lot. And in Oklahoma City, obviously, they're more of a ball-dominant team. Well, they were in the past with Paul George and Russell Westbrook. Well, Jeremy Grant doesn't need the ball to be effective. He plays well off of others, and I think he'll fit in tremendously alongside Nikola, Jamal, Gary, all of our players. But the most exciting thing for me, Jim, regarding Jeremy is his size, his wingspan, 7'3" wingspan, and the defensive versatility that he has. And in today's NBA, to be able to switch on to bigger players and smaller players while shooting close to 40% from three makes you a very valuable commodity. And to do it at 25 years old is even that much more exciting. He's from a basketball family. He grew up in a gym. His dad, his uncle, his brothers. I think it's just a tremendous fit for our culture. And meeting him the other day and being around him and his mother, Beverly, couldn't be more impressed with who he is as a person, as well as the player that we've all seen on the court.
Michael Malone joining us. Michael, before I let you go, I want to ask you about one more guy. You're going to get Michael Porter Jr., who essentially had a redshirt year last year. He suffered a knee injury in the last scrimmage before Summer League this year. So he's not playing at the moment, but what did you and your development staff see from him over the course of the past year?
Well, I'll say this. The first thing about Michael Porter is, you know, when he hurt his knee right before we went to Vegas, you know, I felt sick for the kid. He had spent the whole year getting ready. He put on 20 pounds of muscle, getting healthy, and was so excited to finally go to Vegas and be able to play in live 5-on-5 games. and for that to be taken from him at the last moment was hard for him. So this has been a really mentally trying time for him, but I think he realizes that as great as it would have been to play in Summer League, we still have the big season, the real season coming up in a few months. So what I saw from Michael Porter is a young man who has tremendous size, you know, 6'9", great wingspan, and the guy has a shooting touch out to well past the three-point line. He's been one of the best players in his class for many, many years. He's got great confidence. And the reality is this, Jim, and you know this, last year in the draft, if there's no concerns about his back, he's arguably a top two, top three pick. He falls to us at 14, and we're very thankful that he did, because everything we've seen this year, his development, his growth, his maturity, you know, we believe that we've got a special player, and I'm excited to see him on the court this season.
No doubt. Michael Malone, my guest. I thought of one more thing, Michael, that I think is really interesting I want to ask you about. Will Barton said this about you, quote, "He did a hell of a job. Just to see his growth is phenomenal," end quote. Really interesting to hear a player talk about the growth of a coach. So what's your reaction when you hear that, and how much do you think you have changed as a coach in your time in Denver?
Yeah, and you know, and I saw that quote from Will, and it's always great, you know, because we're a family. We're around our players so much, and you know, culture is probably an overused term in the NBA and professional sports. But I will say, I do love our culture. I love our family atmosphere. It's more of a college type of an atmosphere than probably a pro sports one. But when I see one of our players speaking about my growth, I take great satisfaction in that, because we always ask our players to grow. You know what I mean? And I never want to be a hypocrite. I want us to be, if I'm holding you accountable, you hold me accountable. And I have grown. You know, this is my going on my fifth year, and I was in Sacramento for a year and a half. And I think I've calmed down. I think when I, you know, 2, 3, 4 years ago, I was probably trying to coach every dribble and every game that we lost, for like a game seven loss. And I think sometimes you have to, as a head coach, take a deep breath, take a step back, trust your players, trust the process, and know that you're doing things the right way, even if you have to take a step or two backwards in the moment. So I think I've grown. I've really worked on my relationship with my players, making sure they understand that I care about them. I want to get to know them, and I think they appreciate that. So Will's quote means a lot, just like when we clinched the All-Star coaching bid after I walked into the locker room and the players were all drenching me in water. So a very close group that we have. And I'm not done growing. I constantly want to challenge myself to be the best coach that I can be, the best father that I can be, and the best husband that I can be.
Michael Malone joining us. Man, I keep trying to let you go, Michael, but I can't. I got one more for you. So the thing about this, and I think about this in the way you answered that response, when you're a head coach and you're in that league, you're going to have some really difficult conversations. And difficult conversations with guys like Will Barton, Isaiah Thomas, both of whom I know you love. How did they go about handling those conversations? And what do you make of the way they responded after you had those tough talks with them last year? About their roles,
well,
I mean.
Yeah, I mean, and that's you know, my job as a head coach is to have those tough conversations and not shy away from it. You know, and you mentioned, you know, those were probably two of the toughest conversations I had all year long, starting with Isaiah Thomas, who I coached in Sacramento and have remained very close to, and was really happy that he was here this past season. And to take him out of the lineup and the rotation after just 9 games, yes, a tough conversation, but what so impressed me about Isaiah and what so impressed me about Will Barton is that we preach being selfless. We preach putting the team above the individual, and both of those guys lived it. They walked it. It wasn't just a hollow word up on a wall in the middle of a gymnasium. So I have tremendous respect for both Isaiah and Will, because taking Will out of the starting lineup in the playoffs was not easy. You know, guys had pride, and I didn't expect it to be easy, but I think players will always appreciate when you are direct with them, when you're honest with them. And as I tell them all the time, it's never about you as an individual. It is about what is best for the team. And this is what I think is best for the team at this time. I saw Isaiah in Vegas last week, gave him a big hug, told him, like I told him during the season, it's never personal. I love you now. I'm always going to love you. And I hope we can continue to have a great relationship. And he was great, as was Will. So tough conversations, Jim, are a part of it, but I think if you're open, you're honest, and you're direct, players will always appreciate that and respect that.
One of the topics that, not surprisingly, you clones are all over is Phil Mickelson. So let's go there right now. It is the lead up to one of golf's majors. That means Phil Mickelson is looking to get in the headlines, looking to get people to take a look at him. And sure enough, right on cue, right on time, set your watch to it. He's posting a video to Instagram where he talks about, well, I think I'll let him tell it himself.
Hey everyone, let's get real for a few minutes. I haven't posted anything because I haven't felt good about myself and the way I've been playing, and so I haven't done anything or wanted to be in public. The last 10 days, I've done what I call a hard reset to change and try to make things better. I have lost 15 pounds. I've done a 6-day fast with water and a special coffee blend for wellness that I've been working on with Dave Phillips, and went on a bit of a retreat. I'm here in Ireland now, a beautiful place, getting ready for the British Open. I don't know if it's going to help me play better or not, but I'm willing to do whatever it takes to try to get my best back. I'll have more fireside chats and some funny things in the future, but for now, let's keep it real.
Man, this dude, there aren't enough hours in the day even to respond to that. This dude, is there anything more rich than Hefty beginning a statement with, let's get real for a minute? Hefty saying let's get real means that something extremely insincere and ingenuine is coming up.
Hey everyone, let's get real for a few minutes.
Yeah, because he's the most real guy ever, right? What you see is what you get with Hefty. In terms of what he's actually doing, cutting weight, he lost 15 pounds in 6 days to get ready for the Open Championship. Again, I understand boxers and MMAers cutting weight. Except Hefty, you do understand there is no weigh-in, right? You're a golfer. There is no weigh-in. There is no weigh-in prior to the Open Championship. You understand that, right? Although, for Hefty, there probably should be a weigh-in prior to the Open Championship. And by the way, dropping 15 pounds in 6 days does not sound healthy at all. But then again, when was this guy ever a picture of health? I keep waiting for Elk to break out a story about the time Hefty demolished an entire custard castle a la Monty.
They got this buffet out there, mate, that's so spectacular. They got, and Monty's over on the other side. He's got 25 people. He's got, you know, royalty over there. He's got Prince William or Prince William's brother who might have to a time or two or whatever. I'm eating a cheese sandwich over here because I can't eat when I'm playing. I get too nervous. So, and in the middle of this beautiful buffet is a custard castle, replica of the clubhouse at Wentworth is a castle. It's magnificent custard thing. I mean, mate, if you saw it, you'd say, me, that's a good design on that custard
the
castle.
The architecture on the custard castle.
Just on the architecture alone, Jimmy, is legendary.
You don't need that.
No. So I'm looking at it. I'm thinking, this is great. And Monty gets up. He's at the end of the table. And he comes over. And he gets a dinner plate. And he takes out the ladies' locker room. He takes out the pro shop. He takes out the auditorium on the back side of the men's locker room. And he takes out the porch on the back of the back bar. And I'm thinking, me, he's just destroyed this thing. He must be going to just go over and give it to the whole people, the royal family. Mate, he sat at the table with one spoon. I looked at my wife, deadpan.
Oh, my
I
God,
said,
Elk.
There's not a man in the world that can eat that much custard can beat me. I turned him over at 5-4, mate. He was done. He was out the gate. Fixed him.
It's incredible, right? I mean, I've known Elk decades. And he told that story on the pod, and I've never heard anything better. He's like, hey, mate, there's not a man alive that could eat that much bleeping custard and beat me. I turned him over in 5-4. And that obviously was part of the pod, and those were all actual F-bombs from Elk. So, Hefty, back to Hefty for a minute. Hefty's looking to cut weight. No way. Hefty, what are you going to tell me next? That Tiger is cheap? That Tiger likes strange? Anyway, let's dig a little deeper and see where this guy's head is really at. Regarding the vid, I'm not sure what I like better, the start of that video or the end of that video. That said, nothing says, hey, everyone, let's get real for a few minutes. Like hopping on Instagram to post a video where you say, hey, everyone, let's get real for a few minutes. And then talk about a six-day fast that includes a, quote, special coffee blend for wellness. A special coffee blend for wellness. What, flat tummy tea? Didn't want any of that? I thought for sure the guy was going to start pitching some laxative disguised as tea or some other scam. Remedy that an influencer would be peddling. Because pretty much that's what Hefty is these days. A social media influencer. Or a wannabe social media influencer. And not much of one at that, right? But he's still better at that than he is golf right now. Because he's had zero top tens in the past 12 events. And he's missed the cut half the time that he's been out there. He had that tie for 18th at the Masters, but then he chased out with a 71st and a 52nd at the PGA and the U.S. Open. His only game these days is his social media game, and the game he plays where he announces something really lame, and then everybody that he's already brainwashed into believing that he's something he's not gets all pumped up and shouts, he's back, he's back, Phil is back. Like, Phil honks, and people who actually laugh at his fireside chats or as bad as Tiger honks, who get fired up about his 1 a.m. wake-up calls. So like clockwork before a tournament, Phil will come up with another reason why he has not been winning, and his fans freak out, then get all worked up, and then the guy bombs out of another tourney. And this time the announcement is he lost 15 pounds in 6 days during a fast. Why don't we talk about that for a minute? In other words, hey, everybody, let's get real for a few minutes. Yeah, let's get real about this, quote, hard reset and the six-day fast where he allegedly lost 15. Number one, how do we know it's true? I mean, if this guy's lips are moving, do you believe what he's saying? And even if it is true, even if the guy is losing 15 pounds, would we even know it by looking at him? I mean, drop in the bucket, right? And even if it is true, how is it going to help? Are you going to a golf tournament or your high school reunion? Are you going to a golf tournament or are you a part of the ESPN The Mag's body issue? The SI swimsuit issue? The hell is the point in all of this? Why are you banging on about hitting Control-Alt-Delete on your diet? Do you think it's going to make you a better player? Do you think it's going to make you a better golfer? Even he admits he doesn't know if it's going to make him a better golfer. You're a five-time major winner. You're also a black belt in martial arts, allegedly. My man, you haven't had 5% body fat for any of that. It's not like this guy was Brooks Koepka and then turned into Craig Statler. He's been much closer to the walrus all along. So why do this right now? Because results. Check them. Missed cut, 71st. Missed cut, 52nd. Missed cut. Missed cut. And now apparently, allegedly, his meal plans include missed meal, missed meal, missed meal, missed meal. Again, none of it makes sense. I mean, is that going to make you a better golfer? He doesn't even know. Here's what I do know. Maybe instead of working on that special coffee blend for wellness, you should work on a special driving blend for accuracy. Hell! Instead of dropping 15 pounds, how about you drop 15 shots? Hey, look, I'm not saying you shouldn't be healthy. You should. You absolutely should be healthy. I'm saying have some greens on your plate and some greens in regulation, too. I mean, if you watch that video and you thought Phil was back, you're as big a sucker as anybody who's ever bought anything from an Instagram influencer. If you're drinking that Kool-Aid, special coffee blend for wellness, you're believing way too much hype. Let's see the results before we buy the hype. In other words, for now, let's keep it real. I mean, you've always been hefty, so that clearly is not the problem. But given how you've gone from one of the best to ever do it to one of the worst currently doing it, and you still got me to talk about you on this show, I guess that's something. So you got that going for you, big fella, which is nice to you. I mean, we are talking about you. We are looking at you.
For now, let's keep it real.
We are talking to 76ers GM Elton Brand. Elton, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Hey, Jim. Good to be back. How's things?
Good, good. Elton, great to have you back. Thanks so much. In fact, you and I spoke a few days after you were named GM. Take me back. What was your first season as a general manager like?
Yeah, no, it's a whirlwind. It's a lot of, you know, management of people, which I didn't know. Like, as a player, I'd leave the facility and I'd see the execs with watching sports and talking and chatting. And, you know, it's 2 in the afternoon and they stay till 8, 9 p.m. I never knew what they were doing. But the relationships with the agent, the management of people, you know, just having this whole organization run in the right way so we could be a 50-plus team. 50-plus win team 2 years consecutively. It was a lot of work. A lot of fun, but a lot of work and a lot of pressure.
We're talking Elton Brand. I think anybody who knows you and knows the way you go about preparing for things knew that you would do your homework before you took that job, and nobody's surprised that you've had the success that you've had already. Now, the team is coming off a season, Elton, where you won 51 games, you advanced in the playoffs, and then you went to Game 7 in Toronto. I don't want to bring up any painful memories, but I guess I'll bring up some painful memories. When you think back on Game 7, you look back and that shot from Kawhi, what kind of thoughts do you have? And how'd you process that?
It was tough. You know, watching it, it's a very painful memory. It was out, it was in, it was out again, and then you're just crushed. Game 7, you know, you quote-unquote put the team together to be in that situation, and I'm just walking out of that gym just crushed. You know, it's one of the toughest defeats I've ever faced, and I wasn't on the court. So it just, you go right into, what do we do next? Where do we go from here? How do we get this team in a position to compete against the best teams in the East, Toronto, Milwaukee's, Indiana's, and teams that we've seen improved really fast? You're going to add Brooklyn and teams like that onto the radar now too.
We're talking Elton Brand. So in terms of that, you did have a very busy offseason, and I want to get to a number of the individual moves in a moment, but when you consider a press conference that you had on Friday, and you had Al Horford, Tobias Harris, and Josh Richardson, how exciting is that upside and that potential?
It's exciting for what we're facing in the East. Like, we know the teams. We know the other players. So adding Al Horford, proven veteran, proven winner, been to the playoffs every year he's been in the NBA, you know, 2-time national champion, 5-time All-Star, you know, versatile player. He can play with Joel. He can back him up at the 5, which was a big, big gaping hole for us last year. Great culture fit, respected around the league. You know, it's great when you can add a player like that. Tobias, All-Star caliber player, thrilled to have him on our court for years to come. You know, he fits well here, leader in the locker room and in the community. So trading for him, we looked at him as a long-term piece. And Josh Richardson, his versatility offensively and defensively, young also, it just all fits. So yeah, we have a great chance.
We're talking Elton Brand. Elton, what about Horford? You played with him in Atlanta. Now, he tells this great story of getting ready to go out to dinner one night with the teammates. And as they were leaving, he saw you coming back from the hotel gym, and you were drenched in sweat after workout. He said that that had an enormous impact on how he approached the job and took care of himself. Obviously, he's a huge presence on the floor, but everybody talks about culture. You just mentioned it, too. How big of a presence do you expect Al Horford to be in that locker room?
Big presence. It's the environment you put the other players in. And when you see a person like Al Horford working the way he's working, Joel Embiid, like it starts with Joel and finishes with Joel. He's putting in the work, so he wants to be a champion. He wants to win. So when you got guys putting in that work together with one goal of winning, it bodes well for team success. And when you have veterans doing it, you know, when I did it when I was with Al, I don't think I was playing much, but I had to be ready for my opportunity, and I wanted to show the younger guys, like, this is what it takes. So I'm glad that rubbed off on them the right way.
Philadelphia 76ers general manager Elton Brand is joining us here. Elton, you mentioned Tobias Harris. Part of the process was re-signing him. What did you see from him in the time that he was with you to make you feel like that was somebody that you wanted to invest in?
He's an all-star caliber player. Player of the month, which we know is hard to do in the West when he was there. He's shooting 40%+ from 3 when he came here. The opportunities are going to grow, and we're going to grow with him. Only 27 years old, so just his fit, you know, his spacing, the way he is also in the locker room, high character guy. So I see growth and potential, and the way we want to play with our team, that's a piece I wanted to have, a fit that I wanted to have along with this team for years to come.
So in other words, he's good but can still be better. What about that deal that sent Jimmy Butler to Miami and brought back Josh Richardson? Obviously, you liked Butler's game quite a bit or you would not have traded for him in the first place. So what do you like about what you're getting in Richardson?
Yeah, no, I appreciate Jimmy's contributions to the team. But we're thrilled to have Josh Richardson, add him to this organization. Young player, like I said, again, very talented on the defensive end, and he's a better shooter than people give him credit for. So I'm looking forward to having him with this group and watching this group develop. Training camp is super important for this group so we could come together offensively and defensively. But defensively is where we're going to hang our hats.
In fact, to that point, Elton, I mean, you look at that roster, you've got a lot of offensive weapons. That's pretty clear. But what's also clear is the fact that this is a team that will get after you defensively. How nasty will the team be on the defensive end? And is that going to be the thing that carries you when guys are figuring out how they fit in and their roles offensively?
That's my goal. You know, I work with Brett Brown, you know, daily. We talk all the time. But we're going to hang our hats on defense first, and then we'll figure out the offense because we do have many weapons that can score half court, full court shooting. We're going to add more spacing if that opportunity comes, looking at some players there. But on the defensive end and what we need to face in the East, and if we can get further, I think we're well positioned.
And you mentioned Brett Brown. This is a big Brett Brown house, but I'm just a media guy. It doesn't work unless the GM and the coach are on the same page. I mean, that doesn't mean you're going to agree on everything, but you have to be similarly aligned. What do you like best about him as a coach?
Yeah, no, we're definitely aligned. You know, just his player-first approach. You know, you see the players love him, and he has their back, and he wants success. You know, he works tirelessly to grow and to get this team in a position to win, and that's all he really cares about. So just spending time with him, seeing him bring our vision to the court. It's a special person. I'm glad he's the leader of this ball club on that court.
Now, Tobias Harris has been out here on the West Coast working with Ben Simmons and said that Ben has been shooting more from the outside. A lot of fans, Elton and media, people get worked up about Simmons and his shooting. How much of that is a concern for you personally, and what's been your message to him for the offseason?
Yeah, you know, first year that he actually played rookie of the year, second year he's an all-star. So when I met with Ben at the end of the season with his exit interviews, it wasn't about just shooting. It's about improving his game. So he said, I'm going to come back as a different player. And you know, and I believe it because he works tirelessly and he's not going to shy away from shooting. He just wants to make the best basketball play possible. He wants to make sure that what he's doing is helping his team win games. So he is working on his game, including his shooting. So I expect to see, you know, another all-star type season from Ben. We're excited on his growth and where he is.
You know, finally, I mentioned that I spoke to Michael Malone, and he was talking about how the landscape had changed so dramatically in the Western Conference. And I said, what are your thoughts as you look at that conference? The same might be said about the East. Elton, so when you look around the East and the way the landscape has changed there, what kind of thoughts do you have?
You know, it changed fast. You know, you see, I don't know if I can talk about the other players, but you see teams like Brooklyn loading up, you know, in a year or two, what they're going to have. You know, you see Indiana's improved, and then Milwaukee made it to the Eastern Conference Finals. Toronto lost Kawhi, but they're still a formidable team. So there's some really good teams out there that we're going to face. And like I alluded to earlier, it starts with Joel. Like, we made a lot of improvements, but Joel Embiid playing the way he's going to play and needs to play, it just makes our team that much better. So looking forward to all the pieces coming together.
And then finally, how are you approaching, like, your assets when it comes to first-round draft picks, Elton? It used to be back in the day nobody would ever part with a first-round pick. Man, they are flying out of people's hands right now. What do you make of that?
Yeah, no, I see it. Like, the first-round picks are flying. You can have, you know, a young, talented player, or you can get off a contract that maybe doesn't bode well for your future, or you can get a piece like a Tobias Harris or, you know, an all-star caliber player that can bring you over the top. So I see general managers and management teams are looking at those different, for sure, as we are.
Elton, your career arc has been fascinating. To see you doing as well again as you are right now, it's not a surprise to anybody. What's it like to live and work in Philadelphia, such an amazing sports town?
It's such an amazing sports town. And everywhere I go, like, I take my wife to dinner and it's like, hey, can you do this trade? Hey, what's going on with this? EB this, EB that. Because, you know, it's such a sports town, and it's like you're of the people. So, and the fans are very intelligent. They're very, you know, passionate about this city and about sports, period. So it's a fun town to live in. especially when you're doing kind of well. You're doing kind of bad, then you might want to hide your head. But it's all part of the course for being a Philly. But I enjoy it. I love it. We have the best fans in NBA.
When Chris Paul was traded to OKC for Russell Westbrook, didn't that seem like there was a confirmation that those two really can't stand each other? Or at least can't stand to play alongside each other? Or both? I mean, after all, Golden State had been the only roadblock to Houston when it came to the finals. They were that close. I mean, so how bad must it have been that you had to break that up? So if Golden State was the only impediment, and Golden State's losing Kevin Durant, and they're missing Klay Thompson for most of the year, wouldn't it make sense that Houston would want to stand pat and run that thing back? I mean, sure, the other LA teams or the teams in LA have made some major changes. But Houston had the advantage of roster stability and not needing to work in other pieces. Chris Paul is getting older, but Houston was still ready to roll right now. They're set. And having never even been to the NBA Finals, you know Paul was going to be willing to do whatever he had to do, whatever was necessary to get to the NBA Finals. So if you're going to move him, it would seem to indicate that there was some fire to that smoke about a falling out between Paul and Harden. And then comes word from Brian Windhorst of ESPN that there was some of that. On his podcast, Windhorst said, in one of the games against Golden State in the postseason, Chris and James got into it on the court over, quote, a schematic thing. And apparently that schematic thing was about spacing. Windhorst said, if memory serves him, Paul was trying to post up, and he was doing it too close to Harden, which was making it too easy for the double team to come. Quote, Chris barked at James, and James turned to him. This was described to me by a player who was on the court. And he said, quote, with you, it's always effing something, end quote. Harden said that to Chris Paul, with you. It's always bleeping something, and said it during a critical playoff game. Like, if that's true, and I have no reason to believe that it's not, if that does not sum up the Chris Paul experience, I'm not sure what does. Like, as great as Chris Paul is, and he is one of the all-time greats, I mean, you don't get the nickname the point god for nothing. But as great as the point god is, Harden's right. It is always bleeping something. Like, if you were to make a documentary about his time with the Clippers and the Rockets, it would be, Chris Paul, it's always bleeping something. Because there is always bleeping something. He's always pissed about something with his teammates. Always getting into them about something. Even in a must-win playoff game against the Golden State Warriors. And not even a must-win playoff game against the Warriors with a teammate, but with one of the best to ever do it. An MVP, a Hall of Famer. I mean, how badly the Rockets want to beat Golden State. They want to beat Golden State worse than they've ever wanted anything. They want to beat Golden State pretty much worse than anybody has ever wanted anything. That was their entire focus for the last 2 years. Actually, apparently, you know what's more important to Chris Paul than winning or than beating Golden State? Apparently, it's doing things his own way. Because there he is in the playoffs against Golden State, barking at James Harden to the point where Harden had to fire back with, quote, with you, it's always effing something, end quote. Like, Chris Paul would have you believe it's just a sign of how competitive he is, how badly he wants to win at everything, that he won't let go of anything because he wants to win that badly. But if you're doing it to the point that your teammates, an MVP no less, are yelling at you on the court in the playoffs, I mean, you got to let that go. Now, that doesn't mean that the beard is blameless in this situation. I would imagine James Harden is not the easiest guy to play with either. However, it's his team. He's the reigning MVP. He's the guy that makes that team go. He's the guy that just had one of the greatest offensive seasons in NBA history. And Paul is the one barking at him in a playoff game. And then that goes with the earlier reports from ESPN that Paul wanted more of the offense to be run for him. And that, quote, Chris wants to coach James. James looks at him like, you can't even beat your man. Just shut up and watch me. End quote. Boy, I don't know what I like more. I don't know what I like more from Harden. A look that says, you can't even beat your man. Just shut up and watch me. Or words that say, with you, it's always effing something. To me, both are all-time classics. And both are perfect explanations as to why Russell Westbrook is now in Houston and why Chris Paul is in OKC. Now, that doesn't mean that there won't be tension between Westbrook and Harden. I understand they've got a long history going back to SoCal. I also know that while they might be friends and while they might have been former teammates, that this might not be so easy. They're both, again, different guys and different players now than they were back then. But at least Westbrook isn't some old man trying to tell the MVP how they used to do it back in the day. And at least Harden isn't going to be telling Westbrook right now that, quote, hey, Russ, with you, it's always bleeping something. I mean, that might happen. It might come to that. But it's not going to happen tomorrow. Do you ever think you would see the day? Ever think you'd have another star wanting to deal with Russell Westbrook's on-floor decision-making and criticism over somebody else? Think about that for a minute. Well, now you have. And like CP3, he's becoming more and more tone-deaf by the possession. Nothing tougher in sports than to coach an aging superstar, especially a chirpy 6-foot point guard who's always looking to put the blame on somebody else. So I don't know what they do with this guy now. I don't know if they keep him or if they flip him. But if this guy was difficult to deal with on a team that came that close to getting to the NBA Finals, on a team that was on the short list of teams to beat, if he was that difficult then, do you have any idea what that guy's going to be like if he stays in OKC on a team that's in the midst of a rebuild that got taken down to the studs? Have fun with that. Or Miami. I'd rather see him at least try and get along with Jimmy Butler. Either way, where there's smoke, there's fire, and that's why he's gone and Russ is coming in. Should be very interesting. Imagine James Harden looking at him on the floor in a critical playoff game. Man, with you, it's always bleeping something. Doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of mutual respect there. Freddie Roach. Freddie, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Jim?
Good, Freddie. So we're a few days away from Pacquiao Thurman in Vegas on Saturday night. Let me start right here, Freddie. Given the age difference and how their careers have played out, did you ever think that Manny Pacquiao and Keith Thurman would be stepping into the ring together?
No, you know, there's a 10-year gap there, and I didn't think this would happen, but it's a good fight for Manny. Manny's in great shape. And he hasn't lost his step. He's working his ass off every day, and he's in great, great shape.
We're talking to Freddie Roach. Freddie, in terms of motivation, you've said that, quote, all the media seem to be picking Thurman to win. They consider this a battle between Generation X and Generation Geritol, but we're talking about Manny Pacquiao. He pushed himself to the limit in this training camp, end quote. So, Freddie, how much does the fact that everybody seems to be picking against you and Manny motivate your team?
You know, I mean, Manny, we worked really, really hard for this. We have a great training camp, a great sparring. We actually have 4 rounds of sparring this morning, and then we're off to Vegas. And then, you know, Pacquiao is in great shape. Thurman, you know, I think he's a little bit too slow for my guy. Pacquiao just has that speed, and Thurman doesn't, and he hasn't really looked good in 3 fights. I mean, you know, Thurman's slower than Heinz Ketchup, for Christ's sakes.
Freddie Roach joining us. You know, in terms of Thurman, you had a great quote the other day. You said, quote, Thurman likes to paw with that jab, move around, then come down with that straight right. It's real basic stuff, real basic. I mean, if we can't bleeping figure that out, we don't deserve to be in this fight. We should just go home, end quote. I mean, even for you, Freddie, that's a great quote. Is it really that simple, though?
It really is. I mean, the thing is, I mean, his style, he doesn't bring much to the table, and Pacquiao brings a lot of speed. And he, you know, even though he's 40 years old, but he's a 40 that's in great shape. And his footwork and his speed is unbelievable still.
And Freddie, there's no doubt in the last two fights, I mean, Manny is still fighting at a very elite level. That said, at that age and with his interest, there are a lot of things he could be doing with his life right now, a lot easier than pushing himself to the limit in camp. Why do you think he continues to fight?
He knows what he does. It's still what he does best. He's the best fighter, and I think he hopes to become president of his country at some point along the line. And then when that happens, then he'll retire from boxing.
Hall of Fame trainer Freddie Roach is my guest. Now, Freddie, you and I talked before the Adrian Broner fight, and you've never been afraid to tell Manny when he should stop fighting. What's it like to work with him now, 18 years after you first started to work with him?
You know, it's really great to work with him. His work ethic's unbelievable. And I told him, I said, Manny, I'll be the first one to tell you when it's over. And then when I tell you, it will be over, and we'll retire together. And we do have a great agreement there. And but he's not ready to go anywhere yet. But I'm waiting for the fight after this one.
You are. Hey, you know how it is, Freddie. You never, ever look before the fight in front of you, but you're already looking to the fight after this one?
Yeah, you know, one time and all time. And this one time guy, I don't think he's really a challenge that much. I'd like to go move up and fight maybe Errol Spence or Crawford or one of the better guys in that division.
Wow. Freddie Roach joining us. Freddie, go back to that point you made about retirement. Is that the exit strategy? I mean, when Manny's done, are you done training everybody? You're out? You're done?
Possibly. After Pacquiao, you know, it's been an 18-year run. It's been a great, great ride, and it could be over. I'm not sure yet.
We're talking to Freddie Roach. Now, Freddie, go back to Thurman for a minute. He's gone 12 rounds in each of his last three fights. He has not knocked out an opponent in quite some time. Why do you think that is, and what do you see when you look at him?
Well, he had that bad injury, and I don't think he's really ever recovered from it. And because you see, he's pawing with the left hand, the big overhand right is coming from a mile away. And if Manny Pacquiao can't see that coming, he better quit.
Talking to Freddie Roach, do you think that Thurman can stand in and trade with Manny, or is that a recipe for disaster for Thurman?
I feel like Manny speeds too much for him down the middle, and I see Manny stopping Thurman in the late rounds.
Talking to Freddie Roach for a few more moments. Now, Freddie, you've seen and heard pretty much everything, so there's going to be trash talk before every single fight. As part of that, though, Thurman is saying things like Manny has, quote, these little T-Rex arms. Manny is, quote, this little bunny rabbit, the way he hops around the ring. I'm not going to lose to no bunny rabbit. He also said this, Freddie, quote, I know he likes to quote Bible verses, so I'll let you know he's going to get crucified, end of quote. What was Manny's reaction to that reference to a crucifixion?
Manny actually said to all of us downstairs that he will pay for that. And when Manny doesn't like his opponents, he usually fights much better, and he did. And his opponent better watch out.
So does it feel like this one's personal for Manny? Do you get the sense that the punches might come a little faster and a little harder because of what Thurman has said and what Thurman represents?
Yeah. You know, like the betters know. I mean, Manny opened as an underdog, and today he's a favorite. And, it seems like these boxing reporters all think Manny's going to lose, but they haven't come watch him train.
What's he been like in training, Freddie?
Unbelievable. His work ethic is as good as ever. It's as good as when he was 22 years old. He works his ass off every day, and he has speed and power, and he's not done yet. I promise you, he's not done yet.
Nor are we, Freddie. I got a couple more things before I let you go. Kevin Ioli did a piece on you a few weeks back, and it was a really, really good piece. You talked about in the day when you worked for your father, Paul, who was a landscaper, you were helping him out as a teenager, and you were trimming the trees at the house of Whitey Bulger. I mean, I know that's true. What do you remember about that? How did that go?
You know, Whitey and Fleming and those guys, my dad was an arborist, and we used to go do the tree work there, and – And, you know, I was a 14, 15-year-old kid. I became an arborist later in life and when I went to school for it. And, but, you know, I mean, I got these FBI guys ask me questions, and I'm a 14-year-old kid. I said, I don't know what these guys are. You know, I said, they're just paying me. I said, they're paying me to do the landscaping and trimming the trees. But it was kind of odd at that age, but, I understand it a lot better now.
Freddie, holy crap. You were questioned by the FBI as a 14-year-old? Like, what did they ask you? What was that like?
They said, what are you doing? Why are you doing this work here? I said, well, the guy hired me. Is he paying you? I said, well, that's none of your business. Who are you? And the badges came out with the FBI. I said, I said, well, it was quite hilarious to me at that time, being 14, and the FBI asked me why we're working on C.B. Fleming's house.
Not as hilarious as it is to me, Freddie, that you said to the FBI, it's none of your business. Who are you? And they said, we're the freaking FBI. That's who we are. Talking to Freddie Roach. Freddie, actually, really no convenient way to do this, but really sad news this morning. I'm not sure if you saw this, but Pernell Whitaker was killed last night in a car accident.
Mm.
What kind of thoughts and memories do you have of Sweet Pea?
You know, Pernell Whitaker was one of the greatest fighters of the era, and a good, good fighter, and that's a shame to see him die that way. And I feel sorry for him. He wasn't maybe my best friend in the world, but he was a hell of a fighter, I know that. And we fought in many, many tournaments together back as the amateurs.
What was he like, Freddie? What was it like when you were coming up in the amateur ranks and you saw Sweet Pea? He was a hell of a fighter, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he's a hell of a fighter, but he's so quick. His speed was unbelievable. He was really cocky, but he could back it up.
Freddie Roach, 7-time Trainer of the Year. He is a member of the International Boxing Hall of Fame. He's been training Manny Pacquiao since 2001. That's a big one coming up this weekend on pay-per-view. Pacquiao v. Thurman for the Welterweight World Championship, Saturday night, 9 p.m. Eastern. Freddie, always appreciate talking to you. Freddie, great to have you back on the show. Thanks so much. Good luck this weekend.
Thanks a lot, Jim. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Good night now!